From 90.7 WFAE, this is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Pat McCrory served as Charlotte mayor for 14 years. He led the city through rapid expansion and stuck to his guns when it came to the construction of the Lynx Blue Line, which many derided as a boondoggle. But his success in Charlotte did not translate to his time in Raleigh. Despite his being a Republican governor working with a Republican legislature, he had a tough time during the 4 years he served and lost re-election to a Democrat, Roy Cooper. Still, McCrory is a consequential political figure, and his story is told in a new book, The Change Agent, Pat McCrory's Rise, Reckoning, and Legacy. Author and conservative columnist Andrew Dunn takes us through it this hour. Charlotte Talks, after the news. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Pat McCrory is the longest-serving mayor in Charlotte history. He held the office for 14 years. 14 years of expansion and growth, investment in uptown, the dawn of light rail, and a focus on elevating Charlotte to the national stage. McCrory drove much of that. He stuck to his guns when it came to the Lynx Blue Line, which many detractors called a boondoggle. He pushed for major projects, including what is now the Spectrum Center and the NASCAR Hall of Fame, which he believed would help solidify uptown as a regional hub for entertainment and tourism. And Pat McCrory served on the U.S. Homeland Security Advisory Council under President George W. Bush, which gave Charlotte a voice in national security discussions. But if seven terms as Charlotte mayor was meant as a launching pad for higher office, that dream was only partially realized. When McCrory went to Raleigh as a Republican governor, the Republican legislature didn't make things easy for him. And when Donald Trump was first elected, he offered McCrory no opportunities with the new administration. In his book about Pat McCrory, author Andrew Dunn writes, many people believe that was the end of the story. It wasn't, Dunn writes, or at least it shouldn't be. Andrew Dunn is a journalist and political strategist and founder and editor of the Longleaf Politics newsletter. He's also one of the conservative voices whose writing appears, in fact, this morning in the Charlotte Observer. His book about Pat McCrory is called The Change Agent, Pat McCrory's Rise, Reckoning, and Legacy. And Andrew Dunn joins us for the hour to take us through it. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning, Mike. Thanks so much for having me on.
You're welcome. You say that the reasons that you wanted to write this book, or one of the reasons you wanted to write this book, was because you wondered how such a successful Republican governor, mayor in an urban city goes on to win both Mecklenburg and Wake counties in the race for governor, but goes from rock star Republican to a political outcast in a mere 4 years. Is he a political outcast?
It's a good question. And, you know, that is what initially drew me into this book. You know, I had actually never met Pat McCrory or spoken to him personally before starting this project, but I've been covering North Carolina politics and Charlotte for the past nearly two decades now. And that story, trying to answer that question, really drew me in. But what I learned over the course of researching and writing this book is that the story is not really a simple rise and fall. What it really is a story about meaningful change and the friction that inevitably produces.
It's interesting. You use the word change. Well, it's in the title, change agent. And you don't think of conservatives wanting to change things. They like the status quo. Hence, they are conservative. How do you explain that about Pat McCrory? Because he was a progressive, a moderate Republican. But in today's terms, he would be considered progressive. How do you explain that?
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of different ways you can describe conservative. How Governor McCrory and Mayor McCrory always described himself was as an Eisenhower Republican. And, you know, for some of your listeners may have more of context on Eisenhowerism than others, but Eisenhower was at heart a builder. He was at heart a visionary. And I think that is very much the approach that McCrory took to his leadership as well.
You had, as you said, never met Pat McCrory, which kind of surprised me, actually, because I thought all you conservatives stuck together. But you say you'd never met him before you wrote the book. And yet this is, as you say in the opening pages, an authorized biography. He agreed to fully cooperate with you, opening his calendars, his emails, and his memories. And he sat for hours with you talking, well, going through interviews so you could write this book. And yet you use the words rise and reckoning in the title. Reckoning. Is that how he feels about his political trajectory?
No, I don't think so. I think he does. Obviously, you know, he lost re-election. He's not head buried in the sand about that. I think reckoning he would describe as too coarse a word. But I think it's fairly accurate. I think that a lot, as you read through the book, what you'll see is that 2016 was not necessarily an isolated moment for him. It was the buildup of both successes and mistakes that he made over the prior 4 years of his governorship.
As we were talking about before we went on the air, in the interest of full disclosure, I have interviewed Pat McCrory many times and have a friendly relationship with him off the air, in which many off-the-record conversations have taken place. I have always found him to be agreeable, open, and not defensive, but willing to defend himself and what he believes and what he did, where he felt that was necessary. But he also has a great sense of humor and is willing to be self-deprecating in that humor. How did you find him?
I think that's a great description. That's exactly how I found him as well. You know, personally, I came to admire Governor McCrory. And I think most people who actually meet him come away with that sort of impression. And that's one of the reasons why I think the book is important, because there's kind of a caricature about McCrory that's out there. And it really divides into two different parts. On the left, there's this caricature that McCrory was a moderate progressive mayor who went to Raleigh and turned into a right-wing radical. And that's not really the case. And then on the right, you kind of have this caricature of McCrory as someone who was unprepared for Raleigh and got run over by the legislature. And that's not really true either.
He seems to also, because he was the mayor for so long here, and he was the mayor of a growing southern New South city, and a mayor with very progressive ideas, particularly when it came to transit and transportation, because the words used against him prior to the opening of the Blue Line were blistering. He was attacked by the people who didn't think this was a good idea, without relentlessly. They attacked him relentlessly, and yet he stuck to his guns. But he had this progressive outlook, and yet he kind of has this aw shucks, disarming attitude about him. And maybe it fits into his vision that you write about in the book, where he sees Charlotte as Mayberry and what?
And Metropolis. Yes, and Metropolis. That's one of the key phrases that he used, especially as he came to the end of his mayoral tenure and into his governorship. So Mayberry, obviously the fictional town of the Andy Griffith show, Metropolis being the city that Superman lives in.
Right.
So both of those references may be getting a little dated now, but I mean, that's what he saw for Charlotte, and really that's what he saw for North Carolina as well. But I wanted to go back to a point you just made about the light rail. You know, in your intro to the show, people certainly did call it a boondoggle, as you described. But the great irony is the other name for the light rail at that time was the McCrory line. And that was not a compliment. People who wanted to make fun of it would call it the McCrory line. But today, I think that would be a compliment, but you don't hear McCrory getting nearly enough credit for that.
Well, they ought to name it. We were on the train. We did this show, this program, on the train on the opening day, on the first ride down the track.
Wow.
with him and other dignitaries. The train was packed with everybody who had anything to do with the light rail. And I can't really adequately describe his excitement that day, because it was I think he was surprised, as you write, at the number of people who were there. And that was just the first ride. It grew all through the day. People wanted to get on that train and ride our first Blue Line train. Where do you think, and maybe he told you, I don't know, where do you think his vision for that train and what it would mean came from?
Yeah, so he's always considered himself something of an urban planner. And in the early 90s, you know, there were conversations about transit before McCrory became mayor. Mayor Harvey Gantt actually had a committee of 100 that talked about a transportation and transit vision, and it never really went anywhere. But when McCrory comes into office as mayor, you know, he's taking a look through this plan, and he also is looking at the trends that are already showing up in Charlotte, you know, adding a lot of new people. And that trend is carried through to today. But in the early 90s, there wasn't really a burning passion or really a burning need sensed for transit. And so there's a great scene in the book, The Change Agent, which you can get on Amazon and in person at Park Road Books, where he goes to Bill Lee, who was the CEO of Duke Power at the time. And he's talking about transit, and Bill Lee turns to him and he says, you know, Mayor, you know, you can wait until the pain arrives and everyone will be on board with your vision. It'll be a really easy sale, but it might be too late. Or you can pursue this now when you might actually be able to get it done, but it's going to be one heck of a sale. And McCrory chose the harder path, and there was a lot of ups and downs. You know, there was a recall election to repeal the transit tax. But then, yeah, on the opening day of the light rail is another great scene in the book where McCrory shows up to the first light rail stop. Dark, it's still dark in the morning, and he is terrified that it's going to be completely empty. But already there's a line all the way down the platform. So it really paid off.
Where are the Bill Lees today? Because we have this, we have the same problem that we're facing, the pain now or the pain later, and when it comes to building transit out, and yet we're second-guessing the I-77 toll lanes at the moment, and we have had to alter our plans at the behest of the legislature, because no Bill Lee told the legislature, made those comments to the legislature. Do we have leadership today, in your opinion, that has the vision that Pat McCrory had?
I think we have people with the potential for that, but I do think there is a real leadership vacuum in Charlotte right now, and honestly for the state of North Carolina as well. You know, that is one of the big things that I hope comes out of this book, is that future leaders of North Carolina and of Charlotte will be able to read this and maybe become emboldened to take some of those hard stands and make some of those hard choices.
We have a lot of newcomers in Charlotte who have no idea who we're talking about. They were not here for the 14 years that Pat McCrory was the mayor of Charlotte, or the 4 years that he was the governor of North Carolina. So talk about some of the accomplished, some of the things that he accomplished as mayor in those 14 years that changed the city.
Yeah, it's a great question and a great setup, because you're absolutely right. You know, it's been 10 years since McCrory has been out of public office, which is almost a lifetime in politics, but not it feels a lot shorter for folks like you and me who have been around a long time. But as mayor, you know, one of the big things that McCrory focused on was public safety. So one of his signature accomplishments was the Youth Protection Ordinance, also known as the teen curfew, which people had forgotten about for a long time, but now all of a sudden it is hyper relevant once again. And that goes back to McCrory. McCrory was the driver of that as a city councilman, and then as he became mayor. Transportation was another huge one. Also bringing in Johnson and Wales University. That was a huge accomplishment for McCrory. And economic development was also a huge one. You know, people tend to forget that McCrory was the mayor during the financial crisis of 2008-2009. You know, he ran for governor in 2008, but then had another year left on his term as mayor. And he played a pivotal role alongside Bob Morgan at the chamber at trying to keep Charlotte together as the financial system was melting down all around us.
Yeah, because we were the second biggest banking city in the country, and a lot of our economy depended on it, and the banks were melting down left and right during that time period. But he was the mayor at the time the Panthers arrived, when the Hornets came, when the Hornets left.
Yeah.
When the Bobcats came, when the NASCAR Hall of Fame opened, he was partly responsible for the revitalization of what he called the corridor of crap, South Boulevard, which is now called South End. That's a much nicer sound to it. We have to take a break. We're coming back with more. Andrew Dunn is our guest. His book is called The Change Agent, Pat McCrory's Rise, Reckoning, and Legacy on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and United Way of Greater Charlotte, celebrating 95 years of impact in the Carolinas, strengthening nonprofits, neighborhoods, and people through the support of charitable contributions. More at UnitedWayGreaterCLT.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is Andrew Dunn. He's written a new book about our former mayor and our former governor, The Change Agent, Pat McCrory's Rise, Reckoning, and Legacy. And he kind of had to be a change agent, it strikes me, because he came along as mayor of Charlotte at a time when the old guard was turning over the reins. They were loosening the reins, shall we say. And by that, I mean people like Hugh McCall from Bank of America, Ed Crutchfield from First Union, Rolf Neal, the publisher at the Charlotte Observer. We already mentioned Bill Lee, the head of Duke Energy now, and the man that McCrory worked for before getting into politics. They would get around a table at lunch and decide. And there are all these stories about Hugh McCall looking out the window of his office and saying, well, that's where the Spectrum Center is going to go, and that's where the stadium will be. And that's not, what's the word I'm looking for? That's not fake news. That's real. That's what they did. They made those decisions. But they were loosening the reins. So who were his influences other than Bill Lee?
Yeah, it's a great question. He had a number of influences. He had a cadre of people that he really respected and looked to. John Lasseter being a big one. You may have had him on your show as well. Jeff Brown being another one. But I want to go back to your point about, you know, the people sitting around the table and making those decisions. You're absolutely right. And then as they kind of recede into the background, you know, as the companies that they ran became, you know, national and international companies, their focus and the new leaders of those companies kind of broaden their perspective. A lot of those conversations ended up shifting to the mayor's office under Pat McCrory. I mean, there's a great scene in the book as Mayor McCrory is still trying to get buy-in and funding for the light rail line. Senator Jesse Helms comes up to his office and they look out the window. And from the mayor's office, you can see out towards Union County. You know, that's where Senator Helms was from. And he said, you know, I remember a day when there was nothing between here and there. I know the growth is going to continue to come. I'll support your light rail. And that was a shocking moment for Mayor McCrory. He just kind of assumes that Senator No, as Senator Helms was known, would say no to his crazy idea for light rail. But Senator Helms was an early backer of it and key in getting some of the financial federal support for the line.
What has happened to that kind of thinking?
You know, I wish I knew. If I did know, I would write a book about that and be a bestseller. But I think a lot of what has happened is that we've stopped looking at politics as a long-term game and started looking at it as a short-term game. I mean, everything is about the next election, the next email, the next tweet that you can send. And one thing that I came back to in the book, The Change Agent, is McCrory would tell his staff, both as mayor and as governor, that you won't really be able to know the impact of what we're doing right now for at least 10 years. Right. And I think that's absolutely true in Charlotte. The light rail, I think, you know, the first couple of years it was a success, but it took time for the corridor of crap to become South End. And I think looking back with the... Oh, go ahead, Mike.
No, I was just going to say, and the success can be measured both in ridership, which is down since the pandemic. It's beginning to slowly rise, but it's partly due to the fact that we don't have a complete system. If we had other rail lines going in other directions, it would be far more successful as a vehicle for transportation. But there's no question that it has been a vehicle for economic development and increasing the tax base exponentially, because people who don't remember South End before it was South End wouldn't go there back then. You would stay away from it, particularly after dark.
Yes, absolutely. And there's another great scene in the book as McCrory and Ron Tober are putting together the plan for the light rail. And the city was saying, well, we need to get some bike racks onto the light rail. And McCrory says, bike racks, who's going to ride the bike to the light rail along South Boulevard? I mean, it's a death trap over there. And that was the impetus for the rail trail, which you could argue has been just as successful, if not more successful, than the light rail itself in terms of turning South End into a true neighborhood.
This isn't about your book, but you're a conservative columnist. You write about politics all the time, and the vision that you said that Senator Helms had with regard to the need for light rail is it comes it stems from why people allegedly get into politics in the first place, and that is to do good things for people, to make the country, the city, the town, the state better than it was before they took office. And as you pointed out, now it's all about winning the horse race. It's about winning the election. And nothing really gets done once you win the election. How do we get back to what it's all about?
Another great question. And I think the answer to a lot of that is an unsexy topic, which is federalism. I think I view government very different from the federal level and at the state and local level. At the federal level, I mean, Congress is a mess. I think you and I could both agree on that. But I do think that there are still a lot of well-meaning public servant focused leadership. Both at the state level and at the local level. And I think if we, maybe we just let Washington go off and do its own thing, try to ignore it as best we can, and focus on doing good things at the state and local level.
Pat McCrory was young when he came to politics as a city councilman. I think he was 33 when he came to city
Correct.
council and 39 when he became mayor. So he was young. He was a young mayor, relatively young governor when you come right down to it. And he has a style, a personal style about him that is kind of loosey-goosey and full of youthful vim and vigor. And I'm wondering how that played in button-down Raleigh.
Well, I think it played very well in Charlotte. I mean, he was almost a celebrity here in Charlotte. He could walk down the street and, wave to everybody, and everybody seemed to know him, even if they'd never met him. There
He
was
was
that
Mayor
instant
Pat.
connection.
Mayor
That's right.
Pat.
And he brought that same style to Raleigh, and I think he found out pretty quickly that it did not play as well. He certainly was not the careful, scripted politician that his successor, Governor Roy Cooper, absolutely was. Josh Stein is somewhere in between Governor Stein and but more on the scripted end. And I think in a lot of ways, that sort of style was instrumental in helping Governor McCrory get initially elected. But I think it did cause him some problems as he got into the governorship. Especially, one of the big mistakes that he made early on in his governorship was not maintaining a political apparatus. And a lot of that was for noble reasons. He really felt strongly that he wanted to separate governing from politics. And as you go through my book, The Change Agent, you can see, how focused his cabinet was on making change in a broken Raleigh right away. But not having the political muscle to back it up really bit him, especially as they got into the first legislative session.
You point out that as governor, he went from being the darling of North Carolina politics to, quote, someone who was battered from both sides, boycotted by the left, and second-guessed by the right. And yet you say his story is a lesson in the kind of leadership that North Carolina has too often failed to value until it is gone. Expand on that.
Yeah, I think, it's hard to sum up in a brief segment on the radio. I really highly encourage your listeners to check out the book, The Change Agent, available on Amazon and at Park Road Books here in Charlotte. But what you see in the people that McCrory surrounds himself by, especially as governor, were people who were able to have a vision. He comes in 2013, he's sworn in as governor, and right away the cabinet is making moves. You especially look at Aldona Voss as Secretary of Health and Human Services. McCrory's administration inherited a multi-hundred million dollar deficit in Medicaid. Within 2 years, the administration is able to get that fund back solvent. And I think you see, we've seen over the intervening years since McCrory left office, we're back in a billion-dollar plus hole. You look at the DMV, I mean, that was a huge point of emphasis for the McCrory administration under Tony Tata and Nick Tennyson. They got the wait times down and more or less solved that problem. And then when McCrory leaves office, that blew up once again. I know you've had shows focused on the DMV. And I think what that goes to show is that when you have folks who are interested in making changes for the better, not so concerned about what the political blowback will be, that there is meaningful, lasting, positive change that is possible.
When he went to Raleigh, there was great excitement in Charlotte about this being a great opportunity for the great state of Mecklenburg to make some inroads in Raleigh. And the Republic and the legislature had been taken, the control of the legislature had been taken over by the Republicans 2 years prior to his arrival. So it looked as though we have a Republican governor and a Republican legislature. Oh boy, howdy, let's go to the races. That's not how it worked out, because I think, as you point out in the book, the Republican legislature had already been in charge for 2 years, and they had their own ideas about where they wanted to go. And down the street is this new guy who has his own ideas, and you're late to the party, buddy. Is that the crux of the problem that he faced?
I think that's part of it. You know, the people in Charlotte absolutely were raring to go. They were super excited to have, you know, quote unquote, their guy in the governor's mansion. And what they found was that McCrory still stuck to his guns. You know, he was never the type of politician to give out contracts, give out positions just based on relationships. He really did want to do what's best for the city and state of North Carolina. So there's a great scene in my book, The Change Agent, where early on in McCrory's governorship, Jerry Richardson, who at that point was still the owner of the Carolina Panthers, goes up to Raleigh. He's trying to raise money for renovations to Bank of America Stadium. And he sits down across and basically starts demanding money from the state. And McCrory is, you know, trying to politely push back and say, you know, look, we've got, you know, this is 2013. There's still a hole in Medicaid. There's a hole in unemployment insurance. The money is just not there. And Richardson actually, you know, he leans over to him and physically pulls the governor's chair towards him. And you, in the book, it describes how kind of the highway patrol who provides security is all like, what do we do? I thought these guys were friends. But that what that illustrates, I think, is that, you know, McCrory was willing to stick to his guns, even when people were expecting him to behave a certain way.
Yeah, he was a known commodity here as mayor because he was mayor for so long, and he was in office for so long with such a personality that he transcended politics here. He wasn't a Republican. He wasn't a Democrat. He was Pat. He was Mayor Pat McCrory. When he went to Raleigh, none of that was true. It was that also part of the problem, that this larger stage in when where he used to be a star and everybody knew him, now nobody knew him, and he was kind of viewed at arm's length. Is that part of the problem?
I do think that was part of the problem. Another part of it was, as I mentioned earlier, not doing some of the political things that help ingratiate yourself. You know, for example, it started to turn around in 2015 when McCrory brings in Jimmy Broughton as his deputy chief of staff, who was essentially the legislature whisperer for McCrory. And a lot of the things that he started doing were not rocket science. It was, you know, let's have some legislators over to the executive mansion just to watch some ACC basketball games. That's the sort of thing that gets you political points in Raleigh that may not be obvious for someone who hasn't spent a lot of time in, you know, the bubble that is the Jones Street bubble.
We have a comment from one of our listeners, Philip, on Facebook. He says, frankly, one has to understand the context of Pat McCrory's tenure with the presence and accomplishments and challenges Hugh McCall, Bill Lee, John Medlin, Johnny Harris, Harvey Gantt, Mayor Robinson, John Lasseter, Sue Myrick, Jim Martin, and the Knox family, etc., brought to the table. Accomplishments were either supported or thwarted, due in part to personality. I watched, he says, McCrory's success and failures, and they came in part from the political fortunes of others. On the whole, the transformation of Charlotte was opportune timing for Pat. What do you think?
I think there is some truth to that. And I don't think McCrory, he certainly would never try to take sole credit for everything that happened in Charlotte. He, you know, built on a lot of the public safety successes that Mayor Sue Myrick had, and then Mayor Richard Vinroot. And Vinroot and McCrory remained close. But timing is a double-edged sword. You know, timing may have helped him in Charlotte, but timing certainly hurt him in 2016, where you have the toll lane debacle in North Mecklenburg County. That was something that started years and years earlier under Governor Mike Easley, to be honest, and then continued under Perdue, but only came to a head at an inopportune time for Governor McCrory.
Yeah, the I-77 toll lanes to the north of the city and HB2 are two things that may have lost him re-election. We'll talk about that a little bit later on. You opened the book with a scene at Trump Tower in New York. Donald Trump has just won his first election, and Pat McCrory shows up for what I presume he believes is a job interview for a job in the administration. And a lot, he's still governor, I believe. And a lot of people had assumed that a Republican governor from a purple state that Trump carried would automatically be a shoo-in for a job in the administration. And that did not turn out to be the case. We only have 2 minutes left in the segment, but share some of the details of what happened in that room that day.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite scenes in the book, and it comes right in the introduction. It almost feels like a scene out of the Austin Powers movies as he's going up the golden elevators and all the portraits of Trump staring down from all sides. I think McCrory approached that meeting. He was interested in a position with the Trump administration, if it made sense. McCrory actually came with a couple ideas of how, you know, taking Trump at his word that he did want to drain the swamp and fix up the bureaucracy in Washington. I'm skeptical that that was ever really in the cards, but, you know, McCrory came to that meeting taking him at his word. And what it turned out that pretty quickly evident to McCrory that this was more of a courtesy than an honest-to-goodness job interview. And McCrory was certainly not desperate for a job at that point. And, you know, there's a funny scene. I don't know if I have time to get into it right now, but where Steve Bannon ends up sort of throwing ideas around, like, how about ambassador to Central America? And McCrory retorts, well, sir, that is not a country. That is a continent.
I was going to ask you about that because I have 30 seconds left, but what does that tell you? That he would throw out that offer?
It was not a serious administration in a lot of respects at that time, or you could argue to the present day.
We have to take a break. Andrew Dunn is our guest. His book, as he has told you many times, is called The Change Agent, Pat McCrory's Rise, Reckoning, and Legacy, available wherever books are sold. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to a man that you may know from his writing in the Charlotte Observer. He's a conservative columnist there, among other places. But he's written a book about Pat McCrory, the former mayor of Charlotte, the former governor of North Carolina, the change agent, Pat McCrory's Rise, Reckoning, and Legacy, written by Andrew Dunn, our guest this hour. It's a breeze of a read. It's 370-some pages. But I don't want to say it's a breeze of a read to make it seem like it's shallow. It is not. And you bring up a lot of things that I lived through that I forgot that he accomplished or that he dealt with as mayor or as governor, and a lot of things that I didn't know that are enlightening in many ways. So it's well worth a Charlottean's time or a North Carolinian's time to read this book. I want to go back to Trump Tower and okay. The scene that opens the book, where Pat McCrory is sitting there thinking that it might be a job interview for a job in the administration. And Trump is flanked in the office by Reince Priebus, who is the former chair of the GOP, who is going to be the White House chief of staff, and Steve Bannon from Breitbart, the rabble-rouser who never combs his hair. The way you describe the actual meeting is like they're the ones running the show. Trump is along for the ride. Is that the interpretation that McCrory brings to this, or is that your interpretation, or is that exactly what it was going, exactly what it appeared to be?
I think that's a fair characterization of what McCrory saw in that room. And, you know, this is not a book about Donald Trump. I mean, he does obviously come up from time to time. What I think is the more interesting Trump dynamic in the book, The Change Agent, is in the 2016 campaign, just how diametrically opposed messages that the two candidates were saying. You know, in 2016, Trump and McCrory are friendly enough with each other. They speak on the phone semi-regularly and they campaign together. But there's this scene in the closing days of the 2016 campaign up in Winston-Salem. They share a stage. You know, Governor McCrory comes out and he's telling the story of the Carolina comeback, talking about how much better things are in North Carolina than they were 4 years before. When you look at the economic numbers, is indisputably true. But then you have Trump come on the scene, on the stage, and say basically the exact opposite. You know, the economy is broken. You can't get jobs here or anywhere, and I alone can fix it. And I think when you look at the Trump dynamic, that was very damaging to McCrory's electoral chances in 2016 in a way that not everybody realizes.
And probably the nail in the coffin, wouldn't you say, for being in the Trump administration, because you don't say things that are in opposition to Donald Trump, as we now know. We didn't know it quite as clearly then as we do now. If you're not on board 100%, you're out.
I think that's right. And I think it's also, you know, McCrory could have gotten some sort of job in the administration, but I think it would have required him to bend the knee and kiss the ring more than McCrory was willing to do. And to be honest, I think that's a point of credit to Governor McCrory, is that he was never willing to show the sort of support that Trump seems to demand.
Did he dodge a bullet?
Probably so. I think so. Though obviously that did come to bite him in 2022 when McCrory runs for the United States Senate. I think, you know, there, because he was not willing to bend the knee in 2016, he did not get the Trump support in 2022, and that ended up being the nail in the coffin there.
You are quick to characterize Pat McCrory as one of the most consequential and misunderstood public officials in North Carolina. Dr. Chris Cooper, a political scientist at Western Carolina University, who's on the show quite frequently, agrees with you, because in the blurb to your book, that's what he says as well. He calls him consequential. What makes him so?
I think you have to look at what's left behind and what has stood the test of time. I mean, in Charlotte, it's very clear. You go outside and walk around uptown Charlotte, walk through South End, walk up to University City that now has the light rail going all the way up to UNC Charlotte, which is connected that university to the city in a remarkable way. And I think as governor, you can see a lot of those fingerprints as well, though it's not quite as blatantly obvious. You look at things like economic development. The Economic Development Partnership of North Carolina is something that is the primary way North Carolina recruits new businesses. That was launched under Governor McCrory and his Commerce Secretary Sharon Decker, who is also probably well known to Charlotte listeners here. But then you also look at how North Carolina plans transportation. The Strategic Transportation Initiative was under McCrory. And even the tax reform law that has really touched off a period of unprecedented prosperity in North Carolina can be directly tied back to Governor McCrory. There's a great scene in my book, The Change Agent, where the General Assembly was facing down an impasse, very similar to the one that we just went through over the last 2 years in North Carolina. There was a very real possibility that in 2013, we would have the same thing, but for Governor McCrory spending some sweltering days in the old Capitol with the leaders of both the House and the Senate to broker that deal.
Why then is he so misunderstood?
I think it's because of how his tenure ended, with so much acrimony, such a bitter campaign in 2016. I think that's the title of my chapter on that, is the bitterest campaign. I think because of how things ended, it's been very easy to forget or dismiss or write off, the 17 years that came before.
He was a moderate Republican, and still is a moderate Republican, an Eisenhower Republican, as you pointed out earlier in this conversation. And he was coming to power in Raleigh as governor at the time when conservative Republicans were taking the stage. As we all know, it's a weak governor state, so they run the show. The legislature runs the show. And the party itself, the Republican Party, was shifting further and further to the right. And some would say it is no longer conservative. It is Trump. And he is not a conservative. I don't know whether you agree with that or not, but you're a conservative columnist, so you can chime in on that. Was that part of the problem, too, that he was a moderate Republican at a time when the party was changing direction?
I think that's part of it, but the other, what I would say the bigger part of it is really a turf battle that we saw in Raleigh. I think, McCrory came into Raleigh to a large extent having the experience in Charlotte of being the one who set the agenda and had folks follow his lead. And in Raleigh, there was not the appetite for that. I think, they had a 2-year head start, as you referenced. They kind of had an idea of where they wanted to go, and they almost resented having another person, another power broker in Raleigh that they would have to share the credit with. And I think, to this day, I think there is a lot of folks in the General Assembly in Raleigh who actually prefer having a Democrat as governor, because it gives them a foil, it gives them someone to run against, and it gives them someone to push blame off of. And so I think that was the bigger issue than any sort of difference in ideology.
And as we have said on this program many times, as the Republican legislature makes moves that diminish the power of Democratic governors like Josh Stein and Roy Cooper, they did the same thing to Pat McCrory as well when he was in the governor's mansion. In the first 5 pages of the book, you say that we live in this age that increasingly prizes combat symbolism and performance. And you ask, does American politics still have room for deal makers, builders, and people who know how to govern, meaning Pat McCrory? And you say his was the kind of leadership that the state once rewarded, then discarded, and may yet need again. Which brings me to you. You are a conservative columnist. What's your take on the state of conservatism and republicanism, Republican Party today?
Yeah, I think, that's a huge question. We could spend a whole hour just talking about that.
Talk
But
away. We'll take the next hour.
all right, let's do it. I find myself still optimistic. I think that there is a real problem in North Carolina around the fear of the primary election being a huge driver of politics, both in North Carolina, and we see that at the national level as well with gerrymandering. I take a little bit more sympathetic approach to the legislature when it comes to the redistricting and gerrymandering issue than even McCrory does. I mean, he has been very outspoken against the problems that that entails. But I'm more optimistic because I do think that the next Republican governor of North Carolina will be a lot more like Governor McCrory than you might expect. I think that the next Republican governor of North Carolina is going to be someone who has some distance from the legislature, who can see the culture problems in Raleigh clearly, that just aren't being exposed right now because we have the dynamic of split government.
We have a problem on both sides of the aisle. We have Republicans increasingly becoming more and more right wing, almost fascist, some would say. We have the left wing, the Democratic Party's left wing becoming increasingly more socialistic, some would say communist, as the president has said. I don't think that's true, but take it for what it is. And the reason for that, I think, and I'd love to hear your opinion of this, is the primary system, which caters to the bases of both parties. And you cannot win the primary unless you cater to the base. And then you have candidates who are unelectable or who take us in directions that are so unpopular that we have stalemates. Nothing gets done. We have this problem with gerrymandering. We have the problem of Citizens United, which has said that corporations are people and they can donate as much money to political candidates as they like. They are not people. That's a ridiculous decision. And then we have the need to change everything. What do you think about ranked choice voting? What would that do to help solve this problem?
Oh, gosh. I'm not a huge fan of ranked choice voting. But I want to get back to your earlier point. I do think at the federal level, we are in a very bad place when it comes to Congress and electing people and the primary system requiring us to essentially choose between the lesser of two evils. I don't think we're quite that far gone in North Carolina. I do think we have people, especially around Charlotte and around Raleigh, who have a good heart for public service. I'm thinking about in Charlotte, folks like Representative Cotham and Senator Vicky Sawyer. I do think they have a good mind for public service. And in Raleigh, we have people like Representatives Aaron Perret and Mike Sheetzelt. I think they are both good civic-minded leaders, and I hope that their message is able to break through here in 2026.
You mentioned the term public servant. And that's almost seems like an antique term today when it comes to politics and politicians. But Pat McCrory fits that definition from everything you write. And I knew nothing about his childhood. I knew nothing about his upbringing. I did not know that he was born in Ohio. I did not know that his family moved to the Greensboro area when he was, I think, just about going into high school. I did not know that his father was a member of the city council in his hometown of Worthington, Ohio, at a time when that town was experiencing a growth spurt, not unlike what we were experiencing when Pat McCrory became a politician. Those are the values that he brought to this job, his father's values of public service and how to guide a city through a growth spurt. Would that be accurate?
Absolutely. And I think you cannot overstate the influence that Pat McCrory's father, Mac, is what he went by. Rollin is his proper first name. I had a huge influence on his life. And, you know, I actually spent a decent bit of time asking Governor McCrory what his father's politics really were. Like, was he a strong Democrat, a strong Republican? And the answer was it was kind of hard to pin down. His father, Mac McCrory, was very much a pragmatist, very much a public service. And I think that perspective on government and politics played an incredible formative role in Governor and Mayor McCrory's ultimate ideology.
We've talked about the difficulties and the challenges that he faced as governor of North Carolina, and perhaps for some did not live up to the great anticipation of his being from the great state of Mecklenburg and helping us down the road because of that. But he did accomplish things as governor. Talk about some of the accomplishments.
Yeah, I've mentioned some of them earlier on in terms of economic development, in terms of transportation. I think the Connect North Carolina bonds is a hugely under-remembered victory that Governor McCrory had. That built all sorts of new education buildings at universities around North Carolina, including UNC Charlotte. Another huge one is in emergency response. It also seems like ancient history, Hurricane Matthew, though there are still people in North Carolina who are still waiting for their homes to be rebuilt after Hurricane Matthew back in 2016. But that was a huge success for Governor McCrory is in emergency management and disaster response. And I think Governor McCrory also did a remarkably good job during 2016, during the Keith Scott protests here in downtown Charlotte. And I think, you know, one of the things that I found in my research is that McCrory was in a heated reelection battle in 2016 and could have made a lot of political hay out of, you know, kind of leaving Charlotte to its own devices or saying, you know, Charlotte is broken. But he didn't. Governor McCrory, I think, to his great credit, was really focused on helping protect Charlotte and really deferred to the police chief during those protests in 2016.
But I have about 30 seconds left, but he did support the legislature's HB2 bill, which stemmed from a Charlotte ruling that we could use anybody could use any restroom. And he supported that. It cost the states hundreds of millions of dollars and national prestige, et cetera, much of which has come back since then. But does he view that as a mistake? Or does he stick to his support?
He does not view it as a mistake. And every single person I talk to in this book has their own opinion on what Governor McCrory should have done during that time. I wish we could spend more time talking about it, but there is a very lengthy chapter about HB2 in my book, The Change Agent, and I hope folks will pick it up.
Whoever writes a book needs to find Andrew Dunn's publicist and agent, because they have taught him to mention the book every time he says, "My book, The Change Agent, Pat McCrory's Rise, Reckoning, and Legacy," by our guest this hour, Andrew Dunn. Thank you for the hour.
Thank you.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. Our intern is Emmy Berger. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to visit past episodes, or to sign up for the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.